You're listening to the Cup of Joe Morning Show podcast, hosted by Joe Hunter on the Sound of Life at soundoflife.org.
Growing up, Richie Parker heard the words, "You can't," more times than he could count. This is Richie Parker.
Every step of the way in life, there have been people that said that I can't do things, said that I couldn't ride a bicycle. There have been people that said that I couldn't live on my own, couldn't get a good job and support myself, or I couldn't go to college and graduate. I don't listen too much to people when they tell me I can't do something.
Don't listen to people when they can't tell you that you can't do something, when they try to tell you he is too busy achieving his dreams. That same tenacity has shaped into a successful 36-year-old who continues to defy expectations. Now, his parents did everything they could to give their son a normal childhood there in South Carolina. It meant him figuring out how to do things on his own. As a result, he could do everything his peers did. He just did it differently. He was 15 when he bought his dream car. How many kids are 15 when they buy their dream car? A Chevy Impala SS. Oh, it's sweet, man. Well, he modified it. He's the one that did it himself. He modified it, and I'll tell you about that in a second. He went on to graduate from Clemson University, got a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, set his sights on NASCAR's Hendrick Motorsports, where he landed a 10-month internship, and he impressed his colleagues so much that his internship turned into a career. His ingenuity landed him a job designing car frames and body parts for the organization's racing teams. The most successful NASCAR racing team there is. All right, let's back it up a little bit. Richie Parker was born with no arms. Think about that. When you look at how far he's come, he's 36. He's done pretty much everything and more that a mid-30s person growing up that was pretty smart could do, despite the fact all those people, you can't do that. Even when he went to Hendrick Motorsports, he said, you know, I'm friends with them now, but when I first came in there as an intern, they were pretty confused. They were like, well, what are you going to do here? You know, watch him work. You got to see, it's one of the most inspirational videos I have ever seen. And I saw this years ago, and it's, I don't know why it's just kind of coming up, except the racing season starts in February. But anyway,
the Cup of Joe Morning Show with Joe Hunter.
Might as well get up, do something.
The Sound of Life.
I just wanted you to know a little background on Patrick Mahomes, who really does. I mean, you know, if you're an old curmudgeon like me, you're looking at young whippersnapper, you know, kids nowadays and all it all, you know, kind of cocky and things like that. I mean, he is, but he's really good at what he does. I want you to know something else, too. He's the quarterback that just won the Super Bowl with the Kansas City Chiefs. He was telling reporters last week in Miami that he was raised in the church. He said that's where he is. He is now in his young career because of his faith. He said, faith has always been big with me. He's 24 years old. Man, he said, you know, when I'm out on the field, I'm not just putting on a show for the Chiefs kingdom. He said, I'm playing for God. Obviously, I want to win every game, but I'm glorifying him every single time I'm out there. He said his walk with Christ has shaped him into the man he is today and the star player so many around the league admire. And of course, now, you know, he said, as long as I'm doing everything the right way and the way that he would want me to do it, then I can walk off the field with my head held high and be able to be the man that I am. It's awesome to see somebody that has influence be vocal, said John Perkey, pastor at Nexus Church in Lenexa. Kind of makes sense there, I guess, near where he's from and where he goes to church. He went on, said a lot of things. You know, I mean, if someone looks up to a person, they're a Christian, and say the person looking up to them is not a Christian, I think there's a great impact in that. Maybe it will lead them to find out who Christ is. That's certainly my prayer there as well, too. To realize, yes, I've been given this platform, and now it's quite a platform, and I'm going to use it and speak out. And athletes from all across all the different endeavors and struggles in athletic, you know, that drama of human competition. It's something, isn't it? So it's really pretty cool. So that was kind of neat. Just pray for him and that, you know, he's going along. He's, I imagine right now his life is changing.
The sound of life.
Doing a head count on Mrs. Morrell's kindergarten class, you'll find 22 students. And one of those is Joel Fleischer. So he's been there for like 16 years. He's a little bit bigger than the rest, but he's looking really good. Mr. Fleischer has volunteered time to helping students learn how to read in kindergarten. Why would he do that? Well, he worked for the state of New Jersey for 41 years. He was ready for a new challenge. He said they were looking for volunteers, and that's what I did. I volunteered to work in an elementary school. As part of this classroom, besides just reading to them, said the kindergarten teacher, Chrissy Morrell, he has come to events for kids who didn't have anybody to come. He plays along with our games every holiday season. He wraps gifts for each child. Pretty amazing guy. There's a guy that's should be lifting up a trophy right there, huh? But no, he's not, because he's being, you know, what he does is gratification enough. It's pretty cool there. It's at Clara Barton Elementary School. Wherever that is in New Jersey, they have a very bright light shining of a man who's been around for a long time. His wisdom is passing on to kindergarten.
A great way to start your day. The Cup of Joe Morning Show. The sound of life.
This is a very powerful story. This is absolutely true. And this is what happened back in almost 2,000 years ago. Probably in the 80-somethings, somewhere in there. You know, the year 80-something, way back there in the Roman rule. Two things were pretty common back in the day, and they're still kind of common today, if you think about it, especially in third world countries. One is famine. That's when there's no rain, the crops don't grow. I know in Ethiopia one time, which I kind of have a heart for there because I actually visited there and met some people there with compassion, they are in contract with Russia. A lot of their vegetables and stuff are in, they're under contract. So when they don't have the rain and the crops aren't coming in, the numbers aren't coming in, they really lose out, because their first obligation is to ship them to Russia. At least that's the way it was at one time. So they're kind of, you know, ooh boy. The people in their own country are getting the surplus. It's interesting. But that's not that uncommon. And also, probably, they called them plagues, mainly because they would come through an area and people would die, and really nobody knew why. Of course, those are a result of the fall. I know back in the Israelite times, when God would bless the land, he made it rain, and then you could have fruits and vegetables, and you could grow crops and things were abundant, you know, if you could eat. My mom knew that. My mom grew up in eastern North Carolina and during the Depression. She said, we never knew we didn't have anything. Because we had chickens and pigs and cows and crops and stuff. You know, we had stuff to eat. We had plenty of stuff to eat. Might not have had new shoes, but we had plenty of stuff to eat. Anyway, things I think about. So you had famine and you had plagues. Could have very well been something like the coronavirus. I don't know. Could have been anything like that. I didn't know what it was. That, again, is a result of the fall. Those viruses that are out there. And of course, we know about it now because of the number of people that are affected. And it's amazing how fast it spreads, isn't it? Equally amazing is how fast researchers get to work and can come up with something. You know, I think they got a virus for the Ebola. Remember that a few years ago in Africa when that was coming out of there? And a man who worked with Samaritan's Purse, a doctor who actually contracted it, came back to the United States, and people were freaking out. It's in the United States, you know, and all that and stuff. The news has a very powerful impact on us, the way it's presented and stuff. Well, that was happening back in 80-something. And, of course, when those plagues would hit, this one happened to be in the city of Antioch. And people are dying. And really, you don't know why. You don't know what it is, but they need to be cared for. But people in droves are getting out in the countryside to just get away from it. And the Roman I don't know if he was a general commander, a troop commander, decided to pull his troops out back out of the city. And so he had to write a missive, they call it, to back to Rome to explain why he was doing that. And he did. And it's the first time that a group of people, because he noticed it himself, he noticed that there were a group of people who were staying behind to help the sick who they themselves were not affected, at least not initially. And he said they are followers of Christo, I think is the way he put it. He probably misspelled Christ, but he knew that they were followers of a man called Christ that he had heard about. That's interesting, isn't it? And it made such an impression on him, because who in the world is going to stay back and help people when you're not sick and you don't have to and you want to protect your family? So I thought that was a real lesson, really, that happened, that's not in any of Paul's letters or not in the Bible or anything like that, but it really happened. And it is a great sign to the world, is it not?
The sound of life.
So if you're the parent, or maybe I'm thinking grandparent, I know how it's going to go down if you're the grandparent, but if you're the parent, you got a seven-year-old that says, what can I have for a snack? Of course, that's just throwing it out there, like, basically, I want anything that's sweet. But they don't say that. And so you say, well, you can have any fruit we have in this house. And then they come back with strawberry ice cream. Try again, you say. And then they step it up a notch. How about a banana split, you know? And then that's when you start thinking, and see, that's the thing, though. If you're a grandparent, you know good and well they're going to be banana split, huh? Okay, I'm going to make one for me, and I'm going to make one for you, and you don't tell mom and dad. This is what you tell mom and dad.
You didn't see anything.
That's right.
The sound of life.
To be honest with you, I had never heard of this wonderful Christian man, Sheridan DeVoisey. But I do know we share something in common. We've both been to the Dominican Republic, and maybe you have too. It's a lot different when you go on a missions trip, and I guarantee you there's probably as many missionaries there as there are people on vacation from Europe. It's just amazing. This time of the year, it's really amazing. But he was in the south part, and it's kind of like the east and west side of the Hudson River. You know, it's a pretty good divide. I mean, it's a pretty big island. Of course, Haiti is on the west side of the Dominican Republic, but it is quite treacherous to drive through the middle. It's like Jamaica. It is a hair-raising event to try to go that way. And so people just go around. It's just like, hey, I'll go around, visit, and see the cool towns on the coast. Anyway, the Santo Domingo is on the south side, and Sheridan was visiting in some homes made of corrugated iron with electrical wires dangling above them. I guess they were live, he thought. Maybe they were. You always wonder about that. You're like, man, I don't know. Here we go. But he had a great privilege of interviewing families and hearing how churches were helping to combat unemployment, drug use, and crime. There's very serious church activities going on there. They're praying and stuff. It's always been a big thing of the church. And in one alleyway, he said, I climbed a rickety ladder to a small room to interview a mother and her son. But just a moment later, someone rushed up and saying, and I quote, we must leave now. A machete-wielding gang leader was apparently gathering a mob to ambush us. Wow. We visited a second neighborhood, but there we had no problem. And he discovered why. As he was visiting each home, there was a gang leader standing outside guarding us. Turned out his daughter was being fed and educated by the church, and because believers were standing by her, he was standing by us. Whew, powerful things going on in the church there. Jesus is presenting a standard of love in the Sermon on the Mount that's beyond comparison. This kind of love embraces not just the worthy, but the undeserving, reaching beyond family and friends to touch those who can't or won't love us back. This is God-sized love, the kind that blesses everyone. What did he say in that when he was talking about that? He said, if you love those who love you, what reward do you get for that? Everybody does that, right? Oh, man, see, gets figured out there. Pretty amazing. But that's what happens when God-sized love comes to town, right? Neighbors start to change. Tough hearts start warming to their cause. That is God love, and it is pretty evident. No wonder it's been described as sweet, right? I took a piece of fruit in the Dominican Republic from a man. I don't even know. I don't think he owned the land, but there were fruit trees there. I've never heard of this fruit. It looks almost like a pear, although it's about a fifth the size of one. I don't know what size they were supposed to be. This man was quite proud of his fruit, and he very well should have been. And I thought, well, I can't not eat it. Boy, it was dripping sweetness. I've never had a piece of fruit that was that sweet. It was kind of amazing. Anyway, I just thought, you know, you relate fruit and God's love and peace as a fruit. That's the kind of fruit it is right there. Lord, pour your love into me and my friends so that I can pour it out to others, even to those who can't repay the favor.
A great way to start your day.
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Cup of Joe Morning Show. The sound of life.
People were saying, yes, I will, to a wonderful dog named Bandit at the shelter, but then they would bring him back. And a lot of families, they just, I mean, he's a beautiful dog. When you see him, you look at his face, you're like, oh, man, it's going to be great. But after being adopted and returned four times, it just kind of seemed like Bandit was going to be at the Gwinnett Jail Dogs program in Georgia for the rest of his life. He's wheelchair bound, and he's a sweet, friendly dog, but, you know, he's got this thing right there. Special needs require a lot of care, and they've scared off a lot of potential adopters over the years. Wow. I don't know. It seemed like the right family wouldn't come along, but you're thinking, you know, you just like, well, I hope so, because it's going to take the right family. Finally, a couple saw a Facebook post about Bandit, and they knew that they could give him the love and care he needed. Daryl and Sue Ryder weren't scared of Bandit's special needs at all. Did you guess why? Because Daryl happens to be in a wheelchair, too.
Hey, this is Drew from We Are Messengers, and thank you for listening to the Cup of Joe Morning Show.
Haven't heard about what's going on with the fires in Australia lately. You know what I'm talking about, right? It's easy to call them brush fires because that's what it looks like. But that's the technical name for the area where they are is the bush, right? And they're in the bush, the outback. You know, they have a little bit different names. So they're bush fires. And, of course, they were burning millions and millions of acres and animals really in peril. I don't know if you got to see a little video of some of the koala bears. They just like little people in koala bear suits almost. You know, they were so thirsty, which you can certainly understand maybe, that they were actually coming into people's vehicles and getting a drink of water. One was on the back of somebody's bicycle, I think, getting his water bottle out to get, you know, they know that they knew it was water in there. At least that's what they were hoping for. That's what they got. It's pretty amazing. And some of them have been rescued. You know, it's tragic when just, I don't know how many hundreds, thousands, I don't know if there's even a count on the animals that lost their lives, but you always try to rescue. We're a rescuing bunch. It's kind of the moral of the story. I've seen so many instances in history where people rescue people, other animals, you know. That's our inclination, is to rescue. And I think that's one of the things that's hardwired into us, most of us. I mean, to one degree or another, we run to help people, you know, that we don't even know. We run to help animals, you know. But normally you wouldn't even give a koala bear second thought, but there's a fire raging or whatever. So there were how many rescued? I mean, there weren't meant three. Three, I guess they got kind of famous. Koalas rescued during the wildfire crisis. They decided to do something pretty special. They were at the Two Thumbs Wildlife Trust Koala Sanctuary. Can't say that hardly at all. They're being temporarily cared for by the Australian National University. They're snowy mountain koalas. That's what they are. I didn't even know them, but they've been nicknamed Ian, Paul, and Rick. And there's a very special reason they were nicknamed Ian, Paul, and Rick. Captain Ian Macbeth, First Officer Paul Clyde Hudson, and Flight Engineer Rick DeMorgan Jr. Those three brave firefighters from the United States, military veterans, went down in the plane crash while battling the bushfires in New South Wales and Australia. That's the same region that the koalas were found, and they were rescued there, and they appropriately named them after those American firefighters.
Your daily dose of encouragement.
You got to skip the line pass. I'm giving it to you for Cup of Joe Morning Show. Yeah, thank you very much.
The Cup of Joe Morning Show, the sound of life.
We're talking about Jesus laughing. I'm talking about head back, you know, just like, man, I haven't seen that in a long time. Just hardly trying to get his breath laughing. Some people have done some sketches of those. That's very interesting because it's kind of not like what we think Jesus is. Max Lucado did a really cool devotional. It's kind of something that I need today. Maybe you do as well. He's taking a look at Jesus at the wedding at Cana. It's a very popular theme in the Bible and Jesus. It is a place where Jesus turned water into wine. Why did he even go to there in the first place? It's in the Bible. Jesus and his followers were invited to the wedding. When the bride and groom were putting the guest list together, Jesus' name was included. And when Jesus showed up with half a dozen friends, the invitation wasn't rescinded. Whoever was hosting this party was happy to have him present. The groom probably said, be sure to put Jesus' name on that list right there. He really lightens up a party. Maybe that's what they said. He wasn't invited because he was a celebrity. He wasn't one yet. The invitation wasn't motivated by his miracles because, as we know, the first one was going to be there at the wedding. Why did they invite him? You know, they liked the guy, right? They liked him. You don't think that's a big deal? I think it's a pretty big deal. I think it's significant that common folk in a little town enjoyed being with Jesus. It's noteworthy that the Almighty didn't act mighty. The Holy One wasn't holier than thou. The one who knew it all wasn't a know-it-all. The one who made the stars didn't keep his head in them. The one who owns all the stuff on earth never strutted it. Never. He could have. It could have been a name dropper. Did I ever tell you about the time Moses and I went up on the mountain? Could have been a show off. Want me to beam you into the 20th century? Could have been a smart aleck. I know what you're thinking. Want me to prove it? I mean, but he good and well that would have been so tempting. He could have been a highbrow and uppity. Hey, I got some property on Jupiter. Jesus could have been all those, but he wasn't. Because his purpose wasn't to show off, but to show up. He went to great pains to be as human as the guy down the street. He didn't need to study, but he went to the synagogue. He didn't need income, but he worked. He had known the fellowship of angels, and he had heard the harps of heaven. Yet he went to parties thrown by tax collectors. And on his shoulders rested the challenge of redeeming creation. But he still took time to walk for miles to go to a wedding in Cana. People liked him. You know, that's the way it is. There are those who chafed at his claims. They called him a blasphemer, but they never said he was a braggart. They accused him of heresy, but never arrogance. He was branded as a radical, but never unapproachable. Pretty cool. It's something to think about. There is no hint that he ever used his heavenly status for personal gain, ever. You don't get the impression that his neighbors grew sick of his haughtiness and said, well, who do you think you made you God? You know, his faith made him likable, not detestable. Jesus was accused of a lot, but of being a grump, sourpuss, self-centered jerk, never. People didn't groan when he appeared. They didn't duck for cover when he entered the room. He called them by name. He listened to their stories. He answered their questions. He visited their sick relatives and helped their sick friends. He fished with the fishermen and ate lunch with the little guy and spoke words of resounding affirmation. He went to enough parties that he was criticized for hanging out with rowdy people and questionable crowds. People were drawn to Jesus. He was always on the guest list. Thousands came near him. Hundreds chose to follow him. They shut down their businesses, walked away from their careers to be with him. His purpose statement reads, I came to give life with joy and abundance. He was happy. and he wants us to be happy. And that's why, in the grand plan scheme of things, when he was resurrected, okay, on that day from the earth, I want to come back one more time, still to come. He said, I'm going to leave you with a comforter, the Holy Spirit. I'm going to leave you my joy and my peace. Whew. Can't beat that at all. That's something to ponder forever. It's pretty amazing.
Reaching the heart of the Northeast, the sound of life.
I remember being at the Stand in the Gap. If you were a promise keeper, you probably were there. If you remember that back in the 90s, late 90s, we all went to Washington, D.C. It was one of the greatest gatherings, certainly that I've ever been a part of, and probably you too, that's ever happened. It was totally amazing on a lot of different levels. Honoring God, famous pastors from all over, it was like 800,000 men on that mall, I think they call it, between the Capitol and the Washington Monument, which is way bigger than it looks on TV. It's incredible, right in there between all the museums. Just happened that the group in front of us was from California, Jack Hayford's church. It's a pretty well-known church, especially out in California. He doesn't talk about it, but I have been told that there are many people there in the congregation that are pretty well-known celebrities. So this was all men standing around and stuff. And I was talking to one of the guys there. It's funny because in October, you go to Washington, D.C., all the guys from New York are wearing short sleeves. All the guys from California wearing sweaters. This is kind of interesting, you know, what you expect. But they were talking about the group, and he said, yeah, my pastor's going to be speaking later and stuff like that. Well, one of the guys in the group, pretty obviously worshiping God, was very recognizable. Recognized him right away. You would too. Right away. As soon as you saw him, oh, I know who that is. You may not remember his name, but you know who he is. Very big in the 90s. Maybe a little bit into the 2000s, but certainly in the 90s. And I thought, wow, it was incredible. And it was a reminder that there is not a heart on this earth that God cannot penetrate. And we should certainly be praying for these people. And who knows who was praying for him? Maybe nobody. Maybe something happened and he, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the story is. Not one of those events where you run up and, you know, hey, can I get a selfie? That was before the era of selfies. But, so we should certainly pray and, really have a heart for that.
The sound of life.
Young man started, his name is Keone. And he wanted to do something special for Kindness Week, quote unquote. That's the thing. And that was at his elementary school. And his mother and dad were by his side. And he thought about projects that would truly affect kindness. You should know that Keone was ultimately inspired by San Francisco 49ers player Richard Sherman, because this player, who was playing for the Seattle Seahawks, donated more than $27,000 to cover student lunch debt. Wow, that's a lot of money. For the record, Keone is a Miami Dolphins fan, he said. But this act of kindness superseded that. And he wanted to do something. And he decided to make keychains because, and I quote, I love keychains. They look great on my backpack. And everybody else apparently does too. Once word of his keychains and his heartwarming cause got out, people from all over the country started sending in their request for one of these custom keychains. And, of course, the whole idea was to take all the proceeds and pay off the lunch at his elementary school. But here's the thing. They said, his dad's like, we sent keychains to Alaska, Rhode Island, Minnesota, Arizona, all over the country. There was one lady who said she wanted $100 worth of keychains so she could just hand them out to people. There were people who bought one keychain and gave him $100. It was pretty cool. It was amazing how much support the community showed for the whole project. So with the help of not only his parents, of course, but his grandparents got in on it. Of course you do. You want to get on it, right? It's really cool. They made and sold more than 300 keychains, and so they raised over $4,000 and presented that check they actually presented a check for $1,000 to the elementary school, because that was way over the amount of money that they needed to pay off the lunch debt at the elementary school. So they do what you do. You divide it up. I mean, lunches are about $2. I remember that. You know, I think they've been that way since the turn of the century. No, last century. Anyway, so the thing is, it's a really cool thing, and it seems to be a prevalent issue where people are having to get on board. And you don't know what's true or not. I mean, things get out on social media, photographs, things like that. You have to take it with a grain of salt. You really do. But there was a photograph saying, you know, like a handmade thing on a school lunch cafeteria, no money, no eat, you know, kind of thing. And they're trying to get rid of that, not by selling keychains and raising money, but by having like legislation say, listen, you can't do that. We'll have to take care of that some other way. So it's very interesting. And stories like this lead to that idea that, you know, they try to get laws passed to say that schools can't keep a kid from eating because they don't have the money to do it. So, you know, Keone said, I don't know much about politics, but I do know one thing. Helping others is important because just makes the world a better place. Yes.
Listener supported, The Sound of Life.
Nothing says I love you, Valentine, like a hot tamale peep. And I realized I was talking about this yesterday. They guess what they call it, peeps, is hot tamale peeps. You know, and most people are probably like, I don't care what they do to peeps because I'm not going to come near them. You know, it's kind of a novelty thing this time of the year. And they said they really, it's just more cinnamon flavored, really. It wasn't like hot tamale like they kind of were playing it up to be. So it was kind of like, that's what they, there's a thing called Junk Food Mom. It's a Twitter, at Junk Food Mom. Check it out sometime, yeah. But they said, no, they're not really like red hot on fire and all that. But you have to wonder, it's got to be a publicity thing. Because now you've got a famous pizza place putting a famous Kentucky chicken, popcorn chicken on a pizza pie. Well, that's redundant, but they I don't know what, the Kiwi pizza or something they call oh, they had the Kiwi pizza, and so now they're taking it up a notch, kind of. So they're taking the best food from the fried chicken place and putting it with the best food that we have at the pizza place, and it's going to be available at those locations through the 16th of this month. And only available in the UK. So thank you very much if we were really wanting that. But it looks like something you kind of make up on your own at home. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of like that kind of thing if you've so desired. And then the famous donut chain, not Krispy Kreme's, because I would mention them by name because they're from my home state. Anyway, they're putting like Frank's Red Hot Sauce. I guess they've actually teamed up to create a snack. They did it as a kind of a publicity stunt during the Super Bowl. They made no bones about it. They put they showed the hot sauce. It was like a dare from social media. I'm sure it was. And then they covered the Dunkin' Donut in some cayenne pepper sauce. And so I guess some people tried it and they said, you know what? That's really pretty good. I mean, obviously if you like cayenne pepper sauce and really sweet bread, I guess. And so they tried it. And so they said, now they're at a couple of locations in Miami. So some of the Twitter users suggested an extra ingredient to make it even more delicious. Bacon. Whoa.
The Sound of Life.
Oh, I was talking about the Navy SEALs. I was all fired up. I was watching this admiral give a graduation speech. You want to make a difference? Make your bed. First thing in the morning, make your bed. Be a little awkward if I did it because there's somebody still in it. But you know what I'm saying? But he said it's, you know, I thought I'm a Navy SEAL trainee. I'm going to be a Navy SEAL. I'm making my bed. Who cares if I make my bed? I learned a real lesson, he said. First thing, it's a task. First thing you can do, first thing in the morning, it's a task you can do well, and you will complete it. And it leads to other smaller tasks or small tasks being done and completed. And if by some chance you go off and you have a terrible day, when you get home, your bed's made. You know, it's a win-win situation. It really is. But he was talking a little bit more about the Navy SEALs and how it can train you for life. And a real lesson was the swim they have to take. And I know they train on Catalina Island, which has been described as a geographical wasteland off the coast of California. So maybe they go between Catalina Island, or maybe it's between what's the name of the island? No, San Clemente Islands, where they train. Maybe they swim from there to Catalina. Anyway, I think it's about a 20-mile swim, but it's in the ocean. And he said, before that swim, and that's a big test, he said, the instructors will explain in detail and show you images of every shark known to inhabit those waters. And then they will say, now, to date, no trainee has ever been bitten by one of those sharks. Best we know. But here's what you do if a shark is around you. Stand your ground. Keep swimming. Whatever you do, stand your ground. Don't run. If the shark starts getting aggressive and comes toward you, punch him in the nose. That's the instructions. And so they have their instructions. He said it's a lot like life. As you go through life, there's going to be a lot of sharks around you, kid. They sure are. They're going to be circling. They're going to be like they're threatening you. Stand your ground. Keep going towards your destination. Keep doing that side stroke. And if by chance one of them gets a little aggressive, I guess you punch them in the nose and say, that's what the drill instructor said to do.
The sound of life.
This is Danny Huerta from Focus on the Family. Welcome to Cup of Joe Morning Show, Danny. All right, so I was talking about the couple that took their phone away from their teenage daughter. And after a couple of months, of course, she was talking about it first. She was very, very, very upset. Now, I don't know what all that entailed, but I bet it was rough around that place. That house must have been something. But then things started, they didn't get in arguments after a couple of months because they weren't always yelling at their daughter to get off the phone. And she was more involved in reading books and baking and doing activities. And she found out who her real friends were because they couldn't text her later to make plans. Oh, let's do that, and all this. They had to settle it at school. It's pretty cool. But you got a 16-year-old. He just recently went on, got his phone, bona fide, not an emergency phone deal like your daughter has, but a real phone and all that kind of stuff. And you guys did a contract. So, maybe that'd be the place to start when this teenager gets her phone back. Contract.
Yeah, have a starting point. That's a great reset to go back to the contract and talk about the parameters. It's good to have rules. It's good to have boundaries. Mm. Our society operates well with that. Basketball games, football games. We're not allergic to rules and boundaries. It makes things work well. It's just when we think certain things are rights that become an issue, and kids need to learn how many things are privileges that we think are rights. And so that's part of the training, and you show warmth and sensitivity and conversation and listen to them and empathize with them, but still you're consistent and clear with the rules and boundaries that you put there, and help answer the whys. Why do we even have these? These are important because you're growing up, you're going to be a husband, wife someday, you're going to be a father, mother someday. This is all about building in you what's necessary so life goes well for you.
Good stuff, Danny. Now, I got your cell phone number. I told him, I do have a cell phone number, but I just wanted you to know the number for Focus on the Family is real easy to remember, and that's who you need to get a hold of. And they will absolutely counsel you through situations like this. If you have a real emergency, they know how to handle that as well, too. Their number is 1-800-A-FAMILY. That's all you got. That's a really easy way to remember. Focus on the Family, kind of getting you back in touch with that right now. Write that down. Put that in your phone. And sometime, you get a couple of minutes, maybe you want to touch base with them. They love you. They love God. And they love you to do things the way God hasn't, intended, and maybe it'll help out your family. And they've heard everything, they've been around a while. This is not their first counseling time to answer the call and stuff. And thanks to Danny, he's an awesome guy, and you'll be hearing more from him.
Reaching the heart of the Northeast, the sound of life.
I see parallels here to the early church and to an early city where the church became very evident in the midst of a plague. There were two things very common. Not all that long ago, but certainly would be ancient history, the time of the Israelites and of course, early church, probably for 100 years, maybe more. I'm not sure, but, famine, which is still prevalent in a lot of places today. Famine, it could be in just massive amounts of people lose their life. Famine and plagues. And, of course, a plague could be something like the virus that we're hearing about right now. Could be. There's different viruses out there. The flu is taking a real big hit on kids. And it's not getting hardly any publicity, but I don't want to do that now. I just want to talk about these two cities. One is Antioch, and the other one is Wuhan. And it's amazing what they have that are similar, I think. I never heard of it. I'm sorry, but I had never heard of a city with over 11 million people in China. And I think I heard somebody say it was the center for a Christian revival. Now, how hard China has been coming down on the churches lately. They've actually been destroying the buildings. If it's not a registered church with the government of China, many, many believers meet secretly. They meet underground. Not literally, but they may be. I don't know. You know, we don't know what's going on. There's so much about the church we don't know because he can't let it out. Even the pastor, this Chinese pastor living in Wuhan, the epicenter of this coronavirus. And by the way, nobody in this country has died of it. All right. There are people being treated. But he penned a letter. And it's interesting because back in about 80 AD, I think that's the time. Maybe 60 something. I may be wrong about that. But I do know the city was Antioch, and I know it was a plague and it was killing people all the time. And I do know that the Roman army was pulled out of there as they would. Pulled up into the hills, I guess, and the commander had to write a missive to Rome to explain it all. And he was explaining what happened, and he mentioned the fact that there were people not affected by this plague that were staying to help the people that were. And he knew who they were. He said they are followers of Christo, I think is how the priest that was telling the story, he said that I think he probably did not know his name correctly or misspelled his name something, but it was Christ. They were followers of Christ staying behind. And this pastor is saying that very thing right now. He said, and it was a letter that he penned to the international faith community, he's only identified as a Wuhan pastor. And it's quite a long letter, and it revealing that fellow pastors from around the world have been reaching out, asking how they can support him. You want to know how you can support him? He said, and I quote, "It is readily apparent that we are facing a test of our faith. The situation is so critical, yet we are trusting in the Lord's promises that his thoughts toward us are of peace and not evil." And then he put in parentheses, Jeremiah 39:11, "My plans for you." And that he allows for a time of testing, not to destroy us, but to establish us. "Therefore, Christians are not only to suffer with the people of the city, but we have a responsibility to pray for those in this city who are fearful and to bring to them the peace of Christ." He went on to emphasize that while Christ has given us peace, that peace is not to remove us from the disaster and death, but rather to have peace in the midst of disaster and death, because Christ has already overcome these things. What a perspective it is. He probably realizes that this could be a great move of God, like there already has been there. Been very under the radar, sort of. But, you know, lately in the last few years, the government's been very outspoken. "We're atheist. You can have a church, but it has to come under our authority. We monitor you. If you're not, boom, we'll destroy you." Oh, really? God says, maybe. Let's see how this goes. Who knows the government officials? Who knows the people that will see these Jesus followers in action? This may be a huge work of God going on. Do you see it that way? This pastor sees it that way. He urged the international community to, quote, "pray for God's mercy upon this city and bring peace upon this city through our prayers and testimony." He said, "I believe this is the command of God calling those of us living in Wuhan. We are to seek peace for this city, seek peace for those who are afflicted with this illness. Peace for the medical personnel struggling on the front lines. Seek peace for every government official at every level. Seek peace for all the people of Wuhan." Lord, hear that prayer in Jesus' name. Man, it's amazing. I just think it's amazing. I'll post that article right there. You know, there's things you have to be careful about because of the way the news is presented, the way we find out about all of our information because we have so much of it. And I just really it's almost like a light bulb going off. You know, it's like, wow, this could be a huge move of God right there.
You've been listening to the Cup of Joe Morning Show podcast on the Sound of Life, the Hudson Valley's 100% listener-funded Christian radio station. For more information on upcoming events, contests, to ask for prayer, and to become a member of the Sound of Life family by supporting the station, visit us at soundoflife.org.